Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, Saturday, October 17th, 1936. FBI author gives first-hand information about G-Men. Dillinger's dramatic escape when he shot his way out from Little Bohemia Lodge. Former G-Man starts series with a thrilling story about a battle at Roadhouse in which desperate gunmen escape the clutches of the law.
I'd rather be here doing my time than make any choice that the government ever gave me to tell on anybody in this world. I just wouldn't do it. I'd rather be here than on a street as one of them stool pigeons.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jinx Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. All you wiretappers out there, it's good to have you back with us in the studio. Studio 4 in the classic old Ice House building here in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Now, we don't know when this is going to come out, but, you know, Aaron and I just took a trip up to Cameron, Missouri. It's about 60 miles north of Kansas City, and we went into the penitentiary and interviewed the Boonie Hat Bandit. Can't remember if we said that before, but look forward to hearing a first-hand account of how a man became a bank robber and his fight with the criminal justice system. Seemed like he got screwed over to me, but you just have to listen into the Boonie Hat Bandit series.
You know, I was talking to somebody, and I mentioned that we had interviewed this guy, and they said, well, what did the note say?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we never did ask. I think Vice said, give me the money. It's not in any of the research that I did either. Yeah, I got, Aaron, one more little kind of update. Maybe 2 years ago. How long have we been doing this? We're coming up on our third year, aren't we?
No, at the end of our third year.
Or at the end of our third year. Well, then sometime during the first year, one of the first multi-part stories I did was a story of the mob war in the 1970s in Kansas City between the Spiro brothers and the Savella family, the Nick Savella family. And when I say family, he did have one brother and one nephew who were involved with the organized crime family, but I mean the main organized crime family in Kansas City. And I mentioned a guy named Leonard Crago who was got out of the Missouri State Penitentiary and then did some strong-arm work for the Spiro brothers. Now, and I mentioned that I had interviewed this guy up in the county jail, and he was the scariest man I ever met in my life. He looked at me like I was some kind of a bug that he could just squeeze the life out of me and not even think twice about it. And he was big enough to do that. He was a big, strong guy.
What were you interviewing him for?
Well, I'm trying to find out what Carl Spiro was up to, trying to see if he would rat out Carl Spiro on anything or Spiro's brothers.
Wasn't for a movie or a book.
No, I was working. I was trying to make him into an informant. He was going back to the penitentiary, but, you know, we thought we'd give it a shot.
See if we give him a little easier time for talking.
Right. So I called down the penitentiary to find out about him, and I think another guy did too. Out of all that, I came up with some kind of details about this Leonard Crago's life, and I mentioned him, and I had an informant that knew him at the time. And so I just put together the story, and I told the story. And, you know, I never let the facts get in the way of a good story. Well, I got an email. I mean, I actually made a comment on the blog piece in my website, a man who had a whole lot more information about Leonard Crago. Now, he does not want to, at the present time, he doesn't want to come on the show. He didn't want me to reveal who he is or what his connection was. But believe me, he had a close connection to Crago. And he told me, I guess I must have said that Crago, he kidnapped this guy who was a Savella bookmaker and stole a bunch of money from him. Put him in the trunk of his car, the victim's car, a guy named Al Bickelmeyer, and I said that he emptied his guns in the car, and this guy said, no, he didn't empty his guns in his car, he just fired two or three rounds into the car. And I said that he left Brandemeyer in the trunk of his Cadillac, But he said that Brandemeyer actually was able to get the trunk open from inside and rolled out of the Cadillac while Krigo's girlfriend was driving. They were doing about 50 miles an hour on eastbound I-70. Now, I had not heard that story before. I'm going to have to check that one out with Bill Ousley, I think.
This was after he had shot at the trunk a couple times. And yeah, Brandemeyer, I think I remember the story, had hid underneath the spare tire as much as he could.
That's what we, you know, again, I didn't let the facts get in the way of a good story, but that's the only thing that made sense, because he did fire several rounds into the trunk, and he did not hit Brandemeyer. Maybe he just missed him. I don't know. This guy comments that the full story of this robbery is something out of a crime gone bad movie. Krigo eventually got picked up on a parole warrant, and I made some comments about information that we had obtained from the Missouri State Penitentiary here in Missouri. It was down in Jefferson City, and Krigo was always in the maximum security, what we call behind the walls down in Jefferson City. And I said that what we heard was that Leonard Krigo ran all the, shall we say, convict rackets and the convict situations, the male prostitution and narcotics and everything. And this guy says he never ran things at MSP or Missouri State Prison. He claims that Leonard Krigo was a lieutenant under a man named Roger McQueen, who was a former head of the Dixie Mafia, and he was doing several life sentences for murder.
You know, I don't think I'd ever heard you use the term Dixie Mafia.
Well, it's...
That's a new one to me. We're going to have to do another episode about the Dixie Mafia.
I'm working on that now. I'm working on this whole story here. Hopefully I can get this guy to come on the podcast. If not, at least he said he'd meet me and have coffee with me and fill me in on some of his firsthand details. I did research, and there's a lot of online information about Roger McQueen. And my guy claims that McQueen was a kingpin at Missouri State Penitentiary for all those illicit activities that occur among the inmate population, and that Leonard Krigo was merely his lieutenant. Now, if this guy was so bad that Krigo was his lieutenant, I want to find out more about this guy. Now, luckily, I might not do this, except he's dead now. He had a murder charge he was serving time for here in Missouri, and they got him for second-degree murder out of St. Louis. But he had some other murder charges pending in Kentucky, and Missouri ended up, I don't know whether they community sentence or what they did, but they transferred him to Kentucky in order for Kentucky to then try to give him a death penalty. He ended up being tried down in Kentucky, and the jury gave him life in prison. He did say that Krigo did die in prison. I think I said that he'd kind of lost a lot of his power by the time he died when he went back. But this guy claims that he was still the meanest guy in the penitentiary right up to the end. So look forward to, I'll do all this research on Roger McQueen. He's been convicted of several murders, some kind of interesting crimes. He's one bad dude, so look forward to that, folks. I think it'll be an interesting story. And I'll straighten out the record on Leonard Krigo. So thanks a lot to the man who prefers to remain anonymous right now, and I look forward to meeting you for coffee pretty soon. You ought to go on that meeting, Aaron. It may be dangerous.
You know, I'm not going to comment.
I may have to carry on this one, on this meeting. I'm not sure about this.
Well, you know, the reality, I think, is if you're going to meet him before this episode comes out, so people wouldn't probably even know. They may already be following you for other reasons.
Well, folks, if you see my Gangland Wire Facebook page goes down, and there's like a black wreath up there that my wife put up there. Why, you'll know that I met this guy and I didn't survive that encounter, but I expect I will. I don't think he's that dangerous of a guy.
Well, this guy's not.
No, he's not. But
Leonard Krigo, who's dead.
Leonard Krigo and this
dangerous
Roger McQueen are
some bad dudes.
The baddest of the bad. I mean, just out of control bad. But professional criminals out doing robberies. Six-figure robberies and kidnapping people, and bank robberies and all kinds of stuff. It was crazy what they were willing to do. Anyhow, tonight.
Well, I'd have to say I'll be honest here. You could let me know when that is, and if it's not appropriate for you to carry the Zoom recorder, I'll do it.
I didn't mean carry the recorder. I meant carry the 4026. You guys out there know what I mean when I say I'm going to carry when I go meet this guy.
I thought you meant like, because, you know, it's a podcast.
Yeah, well.
We want to get it on the record.
Yeah.
So now, speaking of the records, we did a series of recordings with Paul Kim, a retired Kansas City, Missouri police officer.
Right, our good friend Paul Kim, who is an actor, a part-time actor now, and I think he has some kind of a scourge-on job, shall we say, a 9-to-5. He hadn't quite figured out how to earn a living. He's had parts, small parts in movies. He's got a reoccurring small part in Chicago Fire that he goes up there once in a while, and he is a policeman. I believe he's a TAC officer up on that show in Chicago Fire. But Paul Kim recorded a series of old newspaper articles from back in the 30s. We like to read those. They have such a dramatic way of writing back then. And I was researching these, and we've done several of them. If you've been following the podcast, you've heard some of the others that we've done. We did the murder of John Lazia. God, I can't remember what else. We've done a couple of others. Maybe the chart that
didn't we have another Dillinger one?
What?
Didn't we have another Dillinger one?
We've done the story of Dillinger and the Crown Point Jail recently, his escape from the jail with the carved-out gun. I don't think we have. I hope we haven't done this already, where we have Paul read from it and then we comment on it. It does seem kind of familiar, but I looked through and I didn't see a finished file in my...
And this is basically the story of their shootout at the Little Bohemia.
Yeah, we did. We talked about the shootout at the Little Bohemia early on, like 3 years ago, practically. This is a little bit different. This is going to be the same story, folks, and a lot of you probably know that story, but this is going to be the story directly out of one of the men, the mouth of the men who did it, one of the men who were there, and that's Melvin Purvis. You probably remember the FBI agent named Melvin Purvis. He ended up shooting and killing John Dillinger in the alley outside the Biograph Theater. He was a go-getter, ball-busting FBI agent in Chicago that dealt the mob a fit back in the 30s. And the I say the mob, the FBI didn't really recognize the mob as the mob, but he dealt the professional criminals, especially the traveling bank robbers throughout the Midwest, but all professional criminals in Chicago dealt him a fit. He was a ballsy guy. Now, after he left, he seemed like he didn't have such a great career after he left the FBI, and they said that he ended up leaving, kind of being forced out of the FBI because he was getting so much good press that J. Edgar Hoover was jealous of him and ended up transferring him into a place where he couldn't do anything, and he ended up leaving the FBI and doing some other law enforcement things before he died, kind of an early death. He may have even committed suicide. I can't remember offhand now. It's not really important. I know he died an early death. He led the raid on Little Bohemia and John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd and the rest of their traveling bank robber gang who were hiding out up there. This was in April of 1934. Now, in March of 1934, John Dillinger, as if you remember from the Escape from the Crown Point Jail episode, he escaped the Crown Point Jail, and he went on kind of a crime spree, and they were robbing banks, and he got back together with these old bank robbing crew, and they were robbing banks, and they ended up in April of 34, just a month later, trying to dodge all the law enforcement that were after them, going to this hunting and fishing vacation lodge up in upper Wisconsin, up in the woods, called Little Bohemia, and the word got out. Aaron, play that very first clip there.
Chicago Tribune. Wednesday, April 25th, 1934. We've got more evidence to work on than ever before in hunting Dillinger, said Melvin H. Purvis, chief of the U.S. Division of Investigation here. And we'll have him before long. His trail is getting broader every minute.
So that was a headline, but this article, actually, what you're going to hear Paul read, was actually written by Melvin Purvis, part of his post-FBI career, I guess. I don't think J. Edgar Hoover would have allowed him to do a writing for a newspaper while he was still in the FBI. So it's a firsthand account of that. Why don't you go ahead and play the clip number one, unless you got something, a comment to make.
Oh, I was just kind of, it was interesting that Melvin Purvis would refer to Melvin Purvis in the third person.
Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Saturday, October 17th, 1936. FBI author gives firsthand information about G-Men. Dillinger's dramatic escape when he shot his way out from Little Bohemia Lodge. Former G-Man starts series with a thrilling story about a battle at Roadhouse in which desperate gunmen escape the clutches of the law. By former Special Agent Melvin Purvis. That Sunday, April 22, 1934, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a telephone rang in my apartment in Chicago. The United States Marshal in Chicago was calling. He said that a man named Voss at Rhinelander, Wisconsin, desired to furnish the information as to the location of John Dillinger. Immediately, a call was placed to Mr. Voss. He said, "The man you want most is up here." At first, he did not want to mention the name over the telephone. He was urged, "You mean Dillinger?" I asked, and he replied, "Yes. Six members of the Dillinger gang are at a resort called Little Bohemia, and John Dillinger is among them." Upon inquiry, he added that he had not informed anyone else of this matter, and anyone else could see that there was no time to be lost. The United States Marshal had previously told me at the time of his telephone call that he knew Mr. Voss to be a reliable person, and it was apparent that this information was real. I asked him the location of the nearest airport to Little Bohemia. He stated that Rhinelander was the nearest airport, and that was 50 miles away. I told him to wait at the airport and to wear a handkerchief around his neck so that I could identify him upon arrival there by plane. I called my office and issued instructions to have every man report immediately. I called the director in Washington and informed Mr. Hoover fully, and it was agreed that I should request our St. Paul office to send men from that office to meet me by plane at Rhinelander. This was done. Almost immediately, automobile loads of special agents started for Rhinelander from Chicago and St. Paul. Two planes were chartered in Chicago. We requested that the pilots be instructed to warm up the planes immediately so that no time would be lost in taking off after we arrived at the airport. Then followed a rapid assembly of the special agents at the Chicago office and a hurried selection of weapons, bulletproof vests, tear gas equipment. I had arrived tying my tie and shoes, as did many of the members who had been aroused from much-needed sleep. The Chicago airport is located about 12 miles from the heart of the city, and almost an hour was wasted in reaching it. The planes were warmed up, and no time was lost in taking off. For my own part, I was thinking fast as the plane bounced and staggered through the raw April winds. I had only a telephone message to guide me. I had no description of the place we were about to raid, and I was totally unfamiliar with the country around it. What was the terrain of this section in question? The whole hurried expedition somehow seemed as unsubstantial as a dream. We knew that we would need every possible moment after arriving at Rhinelander to make our plans, and everyone was anxious to get there as soon as possible. One man inquired of the pilot, already flying at top speed, "Couldn't we speed up the motors a bit? We must reach Rhinelander before darkness descended. Most of our plans and strategy would have to be evolved after landing and after learning something of the terrain." I shall never forget that trip to Rhinelander. The going was very tough. Even the pilot was air sick. The men in my plane were like soldiers awaiting the zero hour. Faces were tense and nerves taut. Everyone knew that the venture would be no Sunday school picnic. Everyone knew that if there were six members of the Dillinger gang at Little Bohemia, they would not come out with their hands up. The descent to the Rhinelander field snapped me out of my doldrums. It was just before dusk as we touched down and the brakes on one wheel failed us. We spun around twice. The wing almost touched the ground, and then, shaken, we rolled to a stop. The St. Paul plane was already there, and so was a considerable crowd. Three planes carrying 16 men and heavy luggage had landed in close succession. It was a red-letter day for Rhinelander. Some explanation was necessary. We said rather lamely that we were members of a wedding party. It was a grim wedding party. All of this had been caused by an event of March 3, 1934. A teletype message from the Chicago office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to our director in Washington told the story. John Dillinger escaped from Crown Point Jail a few minutes ago. I had just been informed by a member of the press by telephone. In making his escape with a Negro named Youngblood, John Dillinger had violated a federal law by stealing and transporting in interstate commerce the automobile belonging to the sheriff at Crown Point, Indiana. For this reason, the Federal Bureau of Investigation assumed jurisdiction and began a search which was to last many months. No one could foresee that we were about to embark on forays, raids, and fruitless searches involving heartbreaking failures, but the nation thundered with outraged indignation and demands for the recapture of Dillinger descended upon our shoulders like a raging torrent. Previously, John Q. Public had displayed an unmistakably apathetic attitude toward crime and law enforcement in general. Now it was aroused. What aroused it is too intangible for definite discussion. Possibly the glamour of a figure outrivaling Jesse James made it crime conscious. Possibly full realization of the danger which threatened its homes and firesides created in it that fear of extinction which usually precedes revolution. Innocent people were being shot down wantonly by this arch desperado and his gang. People seemed to realize that the comfortable concept that could never happen to me might not be so true as some individuals had allowed themselves to believe. Previously, they had watched the battles being waged by law enforcement officials against the lawless element as the ordinary fight fan watches a battle in the arena. Now it was different, and there is nothing so strong, nothing so efficient as aroused public opinion. Three airplanes on April 22, 1934 were converging on Rhinelander, Wisconsin during the late afternoon. Darkness would soon be approaching. Speeding over that wild and beautiful northern country could have been a pleasant experience had it not been for the nature of the mission on which the occupants of these airplanes were engaged. Two of the planes were flying from Chicago and one from St. Paul. In the plane in which I was flying, there was an outward appearance of mirth, and although the high spirits of the men were maintained, there must have been the thought in their minds that some of us might not return. One of us did not. We reached Rhinelander after a seemingly unending flight, although we had made good time. The special agents who had taken a plane from St. Paul had already begun their efforts to obtain automobiles to transport us to Little Bohemia. I located my telephone informant. He was there with the identifying handkerchief tucked in his collar. He told me that Dillinger, five members of his gang, and four women were staying at the Little Bohemia Resort, that they had been there since about noon of the preceding Friday and were leaving the next morning. Dillinger had walked in and announced that he was going to stay there for a few days and that he had been sent there by a friend who had formerly operated a tavern at Fox River Grove near Chicago. The story unfolded by Mr. Voss was that Emil Wanatka, his brother-in-law, was the proprietor of Little Bohemia, and that Mr. Wanatka, his wife, his 8-year-old son, and two employees were being held in fear of their lives at the lodge. Mr. Wanatka had placed a note in a package of cigarettes and given this package to Mr. Voss. Written on the note was the information that Dillinger was there and that Mr. Voss should report this fact to the authorities. From his story, it was apparent we would have a sufficient amount of time to surround the place properly, since Dillinger and his gang did not plan to leave until the following morning. One special agent was sent with Mr. Voss with instructions to wait at the latter's home, which was about 2 miles from Little Bohemia. A man who had come to Rhinelander with Mr. Voss had agreed to accompany us and to point out the location of the resort. While we were still unloading the planes and making plans, Mr. Voss came rushing back on the landing field, shouting my name. I quieted him, praying silently that Dillinger had no scouts in the crowd. In an excited manner, he informed me that he had just met his wife on the road and that she had learned since his departure from home that Dillinger and his gang had changed their plans and were leaving after dinner that night.
Well, Aaron, that's kind of interesting. It's pretty descriptive. I like his description of, and it's a little bit confusing. He starts off with describing the FBI agents on the plane and what happened, how they came up with a cover story that they were a wedding party, which looked kind of funny for a wedding party.
A lot of grooms.
a lot of groomsmen, yeah, I guess. And then when they started dragging those shotguns and Tommy guns up the plane, they probably thought, well, that's going to be an interesting wedding.
Yeah, bulletproof vests.
Bulletproof vests.
Yeah, shotgun wedding.
Really, yeah, that's a good one.
Well, interestingly enough, though, that I guess, you know, and maybe I've been to Wisconsin before, but for him to go, you know, wear a scarf, and so I can identify who you are.
No, yeah.
If you've ever been up to Wisconsin, of course, this was, you know, in April. Maybe it was a little warmer, but if it had been in the wintertime, everybody's wearing a scarf.
Yeah.
Be like, Voss?
Yeah, really.
But it sounds like they must have already known that these guys were coming. They changed their plans and decided to leave that night.
Yeah, I don't know. I've read other things about this, and I don't know that they realized. I never read that they realized that Voss's wife had, or Voss had tipped off the FBI. They may have, but they didn't leave immediately. They said they were going to leave after dinner that night. So I'm not sure if they thought that somebody had tipped off the bureau or not.
Nobody probably would have been working at the airfield there in Rhineland that would have been involved with the local mob guys or with these guys, with Dillinger and his gang. But
well, if it did, if there was, it never came out. They, way I understand it, we'll learn more when we go back to when they describes the raid, where they really knew somebody was getting ready to come up there and raid them or not. It seemed like if they had been tipped off, they'd already gotten their cars and driven away and started driving back through the back roads coming back to the city. I don't think they'd just sit around and wait, especially if they had somebody at the airport. And I don't think anybody at the airport. It's kind of interesting that the FBI, law enforcement, were already automatically assuming that somebody might tip off Dillinger from the airport. When you think about it, that little Bohemia Lodge that's way out in the country, and of course they would be, you know, they would be known when they came land to that airport. I don't care what their cover story is. If somebody was thinking along those lines, they would immediately know these were FBI agents, and then they'd have to jump in some old crappy car what they had back then, you know, in some 1929 Model A or Model T.
Yeah, you wonder, because there probably wasn't like a Hertz rent-a-car.
Right. Well, we get into trying to get cars to, he talked about the agents from St. Paul had gotten there a little bit earlier because they were closer than the agents in Chicago, and they're going around trying to line up cars, and there's not a Hertz rent-a-car. There's no facilities whatsoever to speak of, so they have to figure out how to get cars, which is kind of a story in itself that I believe he's going to tell us in a minute. The description of the men on the way up and kind of that false bravado but yet they're all a little bit nervous because Dillinger and his crew, they knew, you know, when they caught him and Pretty Boy Floyd, they knew when they caught him it was going to be like a battle. It was like, you know, in war. Anymore in law enforcement, usually you go in with some kind of force and they either run. But they never group up and start engaging like a military unit with law enforcement. But back then, they knew that they would start engaging with them like it was a military battle. So I can see why they'd be pretty darn nervous.
Wasn't one of these guys with him a guy who had been a veteran in World War One?
Oh, yeah, sure. Probably several of them were World War One veterans. This is 1934. So if you were 18 or 19 in 1917, you would have been just about right age to be one of the criminals or one of the FBI agents. Vern Miller. Remember Vern Miller? He was a contemporary. He wasn't in this crew. He had already been killed by the Purple Gang, I think, after the Union Station massacre. But he was a veteran of World War One, and a lot of them were. That's where they learned their skills and shooting and all that, why they were so familiar with Thompson submachine guns and BAR automatic 30-06 or 30, were they 30 caliber or 50 caliber? What's a BA? I can't remember what a BAR, Browning automatic rifle. But they used some of those, too. They were a pretty deadly weapon.
It was then 6:30 p.m. and thick dusk. My first reaction to the startling news was one of deep depression. The gangsters were having supper at that very moment, and we had 50 miles to go through a bitter April night over bad roads. We had not yet obtained automobiles. It seemed hopeless. We could not reach Little Bohemia in time to make a survey of the territory and to surround the place properly. Then the fever for action dissipated all other emotions. We could not wait for our reinforcements. We must get to Little Bohemia at once, and trust to luck that we got there soon enough. The town of Rhinelander was several miles from the flying field, and I asked a young man, whose name I later learned to be Isidore Tuchalski, who was at the airport in a Ford coupe with his wife, if he would drive me to the business section. He agreed, and as we sped to town, he told me proudly that his automobile was a special job, geared up to travel 103 miles an hour. When we arrived at the Ford dealer's garage, we learned that our efforts to secure five automobiles had not been successful. it might take another hour before we could get the required automobiles. Mr. Tuchalski's special job stood outside the garage. I told him I would like to rent his car, that I would pay him for the trip and for any damages incurred on the trip. Not knowing who we were and being very proud of his car, he refused. Perforce, I informed him of our identities and that it would be necessary for us to commandeer his car. He then readily agreed. There were no automobiles for rent in Rhinelander, and ultimately, we commandeered four other cars, two of which turned out to be dilapidated relics. We gathered behind the closed doors of the garage and there made sketchy plans for the raid. Six men were to attack the front door at Little Bohemia. The others were to split, five and five, and move in from the sides. We had been informed that there was a lake behind the house and that there were no boats on it, so escape in that direction would not be possible. The six of us who were to attack the front door put on bulletproof vests. I was to wear my steel vest for the next 12 hours. I would never wear one again because the job of carrying the sheer weight, about 24 pounds of it, a bulletproof vest for 12 hours is a good day's hard work in itself. We started. The journey to Little Bohemia will always stand out in my memory. The roads were bad and the night was wretchedly cold. The cars were driven at a reasonable distance from each other so as not to arouse suspicion on the part of the countryside. Things started happening. The commandeered cars were not the best in the world, and before half the distance had been covered, two of them had broke down. The eight men in them were forced to stand on the running boards of the three remaining cars, holding their rifles and shotguns as well as they could, and also holding on to the speeding cars for their lives. Our weapons had been divided up so that each car would contain a machine gun, a rifle, a shotgun, tear gas equipment, and of course, the short arms of each special agent. Finally, our guide informed us that we were about 2 miles from Little Bohemia. I called a halt. All lights were extinguished and instructions were issued that no one could smoke. We proceeded slowly through the crowded timber and the chill darkness. Little Bohemia is about 400 yards off the main highway in the center of a wild hunting and fishing section. A single driveway leads to it from the main road. The lodge itself is built of rustic logs and is surrounded on the front and two sides by crowded timber and at the rear by a lake. On the right side, there are a series of small cottages in which guests can be quartered. We drew up at the entrance of the driveway and parked two cars across it in a V-shaped position so that any flight attempted in that direction would be impeded. The men, swinging their chilled arms and rubbing their numbed hands, made ready their weapons in silence. There were a few whispered orders. Up the driveway and through the thick bare limbs of the trees, we could see the great circle of light at the front door of the roadhouse. It was as brilliant there as at midday. The men began to take their positions on either side and at the front of the house. But our plan to surround the place quietly before our presence might be suspected was instantly frustrated. Dogs on the grounds, sensing the presence of intruders, set up a loud and insistent barking. Those faithful sentinels cost the government the victory at Little Bohemia. Immediately, five men appeared at the front of the house. Three of them hurriedly entered a coupe which was parked there. The other two ran back into the house. There appeared to be a great deal of commotion inside. We were cloaked in darkness. The sound of our movements was lost in the noise of the wind whistling through the trees. It had seemed easy to surround the place and make a surprise attack, yet the alarm spread so efficiently by the barking dogs destroyed all hope of doing so now. Immediately, every man was instructed to abandon all caution and to proceed to his post as swiftly as possible. The men in the car who had rushed out of the house were informed in the loudest voices we could command that we were federal officers. They had started the motor of the car and attempted to run through us. We commanded them to halt, and when they failed to do so, fired on the car. One of the men in the automobile jumped out and ran into the woods. Another of the trio tumbled out of the car wounded, and the other slumped over in the car. A special agent crawled up to the car while he was being covered by other special agents with machine guns. He determined that the man in the car had been killed instantly. The man slumped on the running board had been wounded four times. He stood up, and when we saw that he could walk, we called out to him to come toward us, but he staggered back into the house. We later discovered that these three men were not members of the Dillinger gang. They had come that night to the Little Bohemia Tavern to drink beer. The man who was killed was Eugene Boissonneau, 35 years old, worked in a nearby government camp. The wounded man was John Morris, 59 years old, a cook at the camp. John Hoffman, who had escaped serious injury and has disappeared into the woods, was an oil station attendant at Mercer, Wisconsin, a nearby town. He was the owner of the car.
The fever for action overtook them, and they didn't wait for their proper reinforcements, and they got to get going. Well, you got to say they were men. They were men. They were willing to rush into the jaws of hell in order to get John Dillinger. They knew there was a certain amount of glory waiting for them if they could bring home Dillinger's scalp on their belt.
We'd hate to get all those planes, commandeer all those planes and men and equipment and get up there and get nothing.
Yeah, he had a lot of pressure on him. You know, the director, J. Edgar Hoover, was sitting back there in Washington waiting anxiously because he wanted to hear that John Dillinger, his men caught John Dillinger, so there's a huge amount of pressure on Melvin Purvis and the rest of those agents to move on in there and get him before he left.
And they'd been following a lot of different leads, as it said earlier in the first section of the copy. It sounds like before the phone, you know, they were waiting and they were transferring around, moving around, trying to follow these various leads. Now they get this very solid lead to say, no, he's right here, and to get all the men together to go up there. At some point, though, there was no Hertz rent a car, so even though the town itself was a couple miles away, they had to have commandeered a couple cars.
Yeah, if I remember right, they commandeered, of course, a local sheriff's car, and they commandeered a couple of others. And
I thought they had some of the guys, because they had 16 men, had to ride on the, maybe it says it if you.
I believe they did. They had to ride on the running boards.
On the running boards.
And you know it was cold. Oh, my God.
Men going to the right of the house were delayed in reaching their post by two barbed wire fences which they had to scramble through. The men who were to cover the left of the house ran into a drainage ditch in their hurry and because they were unable to see in the darkness. Those of us who were covering the front had proceeded to a point at the edge of the clearing just outside the arc of light emanating from the front of the house. Gunfire had begun from the upper stories of the left side of the lodge. For a moment, I did not notice the flash of fire from another sector. Then a bullet hit the ground a yard from my right foot, and two other bullets struck trees behind me. I suddenly realized that I was being shot at, and I didn't like it. The shots were coming from the vicinity of a small cabin on the right side of the lodge. I whirled about, my machine gun jammed. I threw it on the ground and returned the fire with an automatic pistol at a short, slender figure which was fleeing towards the woods. I was trading fire with Babyface Nelson. Nelson, quartered in the cabin, had, with astonishing folly, delayed his departure to swing his gun through a sweeping arc into the red-spitting darkness. It was later verified that this was actually Nelson after we had traced the movements of the hoodlums who had escaped from Little Bohemia. For a time, the noise was deafening. The men on the left side of the lodge, after their scramble out of the ditch, discovered that they were being fired upon from the upper windows, and they answered. For what seemed like an endless interval, there was not even a small pocket of quiet. Then abruptly, the fire from the roadhouse ceased. The machine gun and rifle fire continued for what seemed an interminable length of time. It was, in reality, only a few minutes. We did not know that at that moment the hoodlums were scrambling out a rear second-story window and moving toward the right side of the lodge, through the brush at the lakefront to freedom. We do not know how they escaped. Most probably they had gone to the north by the edge of the lake and through the woods during the time when the men were becoming disentangled from the barbed wire fences, which they had run into in their hurried effort to get to their posts. In the meantime, Special Agents Jay Newman and Carter Baum were sent to the nearest telephone, which was in a country store nearby owned by a man named Kerner, for the purpose of calling the other special agents who were proceeding to Little Bohemia by automobile to let them know where we were. We shouted at intervals, commanding those who were in the house to come out. Finally, Mr. Wanatka, the proprietor of Little Bohemia, and two waiters came filing through the front door with their hands up. They had sought refuge in the cellar during the main part of the fire. The proprietor was very excited and frightened. He said there were still four men in the house. Every man was visited at his post and given this information. The ominous silence in the lodge lent color to the belief that the gangsters were awaiting our onslaught. and since we had the place covered and we decided first to attend to the wounded men and then to throw our gas shells in the windows of the lodge. An ambulance was called from the CCC camp to take care of our casualties. Nothing but rank stupidity and suicidal intent would have projected any man into that arc of light at that time. The proprietor of Little Bohemia had come out of the house without a coat, and in the bitter cold night air would soon be suffering from exposure. He asked if he might go to a nearby friend's house to obtain a coat. He was granted this permission. After a time, he came back. He was out of breath from running. "Someone is holding up your men at Mr. Kerner's house," he said. Two special agents were immediately dispatched to that point. Finally, they returned. I seemed to dread their report. They stated that Special Agent Carter Baum had been killed instantly, and that both Special Agent Jay Newman and Mr. Carl Christensen, a local deputy constable who had joined them, had been severely wounded by one of the Dillinger gang. These men were sent at once to Ironwood, Michigan, where the nearest hospital is located. We learned that these three men, upon arriving at the house where they were to make the telephone call, had seen an automobile in which three people were seated. One of the special agents asked Mr. Christensen whose car it was, and the latter replied that it was all right and that it belonged to Mr. Kerner. Baum, Newman, and Christensen stopped their car in front of the house. As they neared the other car, a figure moved out from behind it. It was Babyface Nelson. In his hand was an automatic. He spoke fast. "I know you. You have on bulletproof vests, so I will give it to you high and low." He began firing as he spoke. Baum was killed almost instantly. Jay Newman made several grabs to get the automatic in Nelson's hands, but failed to reach it. He received a wound in the head and fell. Nelson leaped into the car in which the agents and Christensen had driven up and drove away. Newman regained consciousness sufficiently to see the car disappearing about 100 yards away, and he emptied his automatic at it, but the bullets had no effect. There was no one to give pursuit. The car Nelson had taken was the one we had commandeered, and the one which had been geared up to a speed of 103 miles per hour. Kerner told us that Nelson had appeared at his store, brandishing a gun and demanding a car. He was just about to leave in a car belonging to a native when the special agents and the deputy constable drove up. We continued to maintain our cover of the Little Bohemia Lodge, but it became more and more evident that all of the gangsters had escaped before the proprietor left the house. We searched the grounds and in the garages. We found the Buick coupe and the Ford sedan belonging to the gang. Both were fully packed with luggage and contained the gang's machine guns, bulletproof vests, rifles, tear gas, and ammunition. We then started to gas the house by shooting gas shells at the windows. Two of our men in an automobile rushed up to the front of the house while we covered it with machine guns to protect their advance. They threw gas bombs into the front door. Every one of us surrounding the place was gassed by our own tear gas. We then started to gas the house by shooting gas shells at the windows. Every one of us surrounding the place was gassed by our own tear gas, blown toward us by the wind. After a time, we heard a woman's voice in the house crying out, "We will come out if you stop firing." We replied, "Come out and bring everyone with you with your hands up." Three women came out. They said they did not know whether anyone else was in the house, and continued questioning failed to break down their statements. These were the women with the Dillinger gang.
Well, that's a heck of a story, isn't it, Aaron? Those three poor old gals in there, they're shooting tear gas. They blew out every window in that place, it sounds like, and permeated it with gas. You probably couldn't, I don't know how they would have gotten all that out of there.
You would think that, you know, kind of like when the fire died down, because I know where he was saying it was only, you know, like a few minutes, and then suddenly the fire kind of dies down.
Yeah.
That was probably when all those guys made their way to the back of the house, or the back of the lodge, and jumped out the window and headed to get away.
Yeah, they ran up the road, at least Babyface Nelson. They probably dispersed all every which way they could go, but Babyface Nelson ran up the road to where that other guy lived. That's how he was able to get the drop on those agents. That was an up-close and personal fight there, wasn't it? They reached out, was close enough to try to grab Babyface Nelson's machine gun as he was shot him down and killed him.
Man.
Now you understand why when they actually, the agents few months later, actually catch Babyface Nelson that he did not sort of walk away from that encounter with the FBI.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they'd already had wounded from the guys that this, of the 16. I'm trying to, I don't think I ever got a real good count.
No.
Other than Jay Newman and Carter Baum.
Yeah.
One being injured, and then, of course, the deputy being injured as well. But there was two waiters. You think they were getting tipped well?
Not well enough.
I know.
They might have tipped really well, but not well enough.
I mean, are you really going to refuse service to Babyface Nelson?
And they'd kind of, in effect, held that whole staff and family hostage for a week. They'd been there for a week. I read somewhere where he gave them $500 cash money for his gang to stay there for that week. I guess, and they were right. They were getting ready to leave town, and they found that they'd already packed up their cars with their guns and bulletproof vests. So they kind of caught them with their pants down in a way. If all that, all the guns and bulletproof vests were already in their car, they just grabbed a few guns and started shooting and then got out the back.
Yeah, they didn't have the majority of their firearms with them if they're all packed up in the car.
Right, and at least that's what Purvis reports.
And then the fact that Mr. Turner, who's running the store down the street, goes, oh no, that's this one guy's car coming towards us.
I liked your description of that one car. Some car that they had borrowed is geared up to do 103 mile per hour.
They probably know that because they were doing that to get to Little Bohemia.
I don't know. On those roads up, there's back roads up through the woods, the northern Wisconsin woods, to get to a resort like that, I don't know if you'd be doing much over 20 or 30 mile an hour.
But at this point, they'd also have the Dillinger and Babyface. There was a couple cars in the garage. They weren't really stranded.
No, Dillinger, they had their cars in the garage, but they couldn't get to them. They weren't able. They were afraid to go get in the cars and leave. And plus, they wanted to just leave those women there.
Well, but I'm saying that the FBI agents, Purvis and him, could have jumped in the...
Oh, yeah, they could have gotten them. Problem is, Dillinger and whoever else was with him were all on foot out in the woods. So, driving around the cars... You needed dogs and trackers by that point in time, and they were not really prepared for all that. Had they taken a little more time and got better prepared, that would have gone totally differently. That's what happens when you jump into something unprepared like that. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, not knowing the terrain.
Right.
Right, and, sending men on the right and left flank, and they don't really know the terrain either, and it's all dark, and you're moving up on a house where you know these guys are at, and they're dangerous men.
Yeah, I apparently didn't have anybody that covered the back, which is paramount. I know that from my attack unit days. You better get somebody covering the back, because that's the first place they go is out the back door when the police are coming to the front, or even to the front and the sides. You run right out the back door and you're gone. But you got somebody laying. You got a couple guys laying out in back. When you come out that back door, they just pop you. You're done. You're a dead goose. The gangsters on the inside were alerted and grabbing their guns and starting to fire out the window and make plans to get out the back and get away. Because like I said before, they don't really want to engage. They will. These guys definitely would, but they don't particularly want to engage. They'd rather get away.
A group of six special agents rushed the first floor of the lodge, becoming gassed by the tear gas. We rushed the second floor and then ran out and put our heads speedily under the pump. When we had recovered from the first gassing, we rushed the cellar and the top floor. After a thorough search, we found to our chagrin that every one of the gangsters had escaped. Three women and a much shot-up house, which was later to prove of great financial benefit to its proprietor, were all we had to show for our efforts. During the night, while we were covering the place, a car approached and turned into the lane. There it stopped, its driver apparently suspecting that something was wrong. We approached the car and commanded the occupants to get out with their hands up. They immediately began backing out. We endeavored to disable the car by machine gun fire into the radiator. Some months later, we learned that its driver was Pat Riley, a former mascot of the Minneapolis baseball team, who had joined up with his gang to take a minor part. Companion was Pat Charrington, a former nightclub dancer and performer. These two had been to St. Paul, Minnesota for the purpose of obtaining more ammunition. Pat Charrington, upon apprehension, had a slight scratch between her eyes, caused by flying glass as a result of the firing upon the car in which she and Riley were riding in that night. They escaped, and as the story later came to me, Pat Riley hid out in the icy fields all night and finally made his way back to St. Paul. The story of the battle had spread rapidly over the countryside. As the dawn was breaking, a posse had approached. They had wanted to join in the battle, but the fighting was over. Washington had been on the telephone all night. Mr. Hoover had been pacing the floor and had been in almost constant communication with a special agent who had been sent to the telephone at the home of a resident, which local people called the Central. Final report was made to him early that morning, and plans were made for the investigations which would necessarily follow in that section. In small groups, we went at different times to have breakfast at Mr. Voss's house. Most of us didn't feel like eating. A group was selected to remain at Little Bohemia to complete the investigation, and the rest of us returned to our headquarters. We soon learned that Dillinger and two of his gang had appeared at Ed Mitchell's Rest Lake Resort, about 2 miles north of Little Bohemia, where they tore the telephone from the wall, threatened to kill Mitchell and his family, and demanded a car. Mitchell told them his car had not been used for some months and probably would not have run, but that his hired man had a truck. On the way to get this, the gangster saw the Ford coupe belonging to Robert Johnson, a tenant of the resort. They forced Johnson to drive them about 35 miles across country to Park Falls, where they allowed him to get out and then sped away in his car. There followed expressions of great dissatisfaction at the utter failure of this raid. While waiting at the airport for the plans to be warmed up to take me back to Chicago, I overheard several people talking about the raid in an extremely critical vein. Stories began to circulate. Wild rumors as to what happened at Little Bohemia floated in the air. One story, created by some inane individual with more regard for melodrama than for truth, was that there had been a mutiny of the special agents and that I, with two others, had been held in a garage at the point of a gun by the other special agents. A petition was circulated by two disgruntled individuals demanding my removal from office. Several people signed it. Large black headlines appeared in the newspapers: urge Purvis ouster, demand Purvis quit in Dillinger fiasco. The raid had failed. At Little Bohemia, we had probably the largest aggregation of modern desperados ever bottled up in one place. Never again would we have such a great opportunity as was afforded us there. There had seemed no avenue by which they could escape, and yet they did escape, and all we had to show for our battle were three terrified women. The events of the night ran constantly through my mind. I relived every moment of the raid. I could see that we had failed, but I could not see that we had failed through our own fault, or how the affair could have been planned in the time available in any other way. Perhaps I was too close to the picture to see the fine points of it. I offered my resignation. I did not want to, and I did not do so because of criticism directed against me personally, but because of the storm of unjustified criticism directed against the organization which had not been at fault. It was not accepted. Somehow, I wasn't thinking about the various opinions advanced about the raid. My thoughts were about the loss of Special Agent Carter Baum and the other serious casualties at Little Bohemia. That young special agent was my friend. I thought of his boyish ways and lovable character. I remembered how he had loved to play handball. I thought, too, of his devotion to duty and his intelligence, the high aims and ideals which he had. Then I thought of that life being snuffed out by a gun in the hands of a ruthless and irresponsible killer. There was the family of this man who had lost his life in line of duty, Mrs. Baum and her two little children. What would happen to them? I thought of the inadequacy of the government support for this family. The story of the battle is told and retold, and the empty shells of the cartridges fired there have had a ready market. The luggage of the Dillinger gang, which was discovered in the two automobiles left at Little Bohemia, contained the instruments of gang warfare: machine guns, rifles, pistols, bulletproof vests, and ammunition, together with a large number of suits, shirts, and other articles of clothing. The gang had already packed and were ready to leave. Some months later, all the articles of clothing were sent back to the proprietor of Little Bohemia. Some felt that possibly he might have a claim of some sort on them in view of the sojourn of the Dillinger gang at his resort. My own feeling was that he would have and would make no claim for these articles, but these considerations occupied very little of my concern at the time. I am told, however, that later these articles became a part of his murderous relics. The gangsters at Little Bohemia were John Dillinger, John Hamilton, an old prison pal of Dillinger who had escaped from the Michigan City, Indiana prison on March 28, 1933, and who had been his companion in many a robbery. Homer Van Meter, the so-called frontman, or caser for the gang. Tommy Carroll, a not-so-widely known gang member, but who often helped when an extra man was needed for a job. Babyface Nelson, whose ruling passion was murder. And Pat Riley. They were all dangerous men, and word had leaked through from gangland that each had said he would never be taken alive. Only one of them was. Pat Riley was captured and sent to prison. The others died of gunfire.
Well, that was quite a story by our friend Melvin Purvis, written, about three, I believe it was 1936, so it had been 2 years after this happened. I think it's pretty accurate. It's, I like the way he dealt with the kind of the repercussions of the failed raid and the dead agent and how he offered his resignation and they wouldn't accept it. But there was a lot of criticism heaped on that whole crew, even though they did the best they could under the circumstances, I think. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, I think that they went into a situation that they were underprepared for. But it was funny that it was a St. Paul mascot.
Oh, yeah, he was a mascot of some St. Paul football team or university, some team. I remember reading about him. He was, what'd they say, he had gone out to buy him more ammunition, and he had some exotic dancer with him. So
bringing in the girls.
Bringing in another girl and some more ammunition. I tell you what, this crew was, they were quite a crew, weren't they? How'd you like to have been there during that week? They were all there drinking and playing cards, and I don't know, I suppose they might have gone fishing. It was right on a lake, I believe.
I would have wanted cash tips and not had it put on the account, because I'm guessing if they had a bill at the hotel that never really got paid off.
It seemed like I remember that he paid him $500. I believe I said that earlier. Yeah. He paid him $500 in advance. But you know what's interesting
all the
is
bullet holes and the tear gas.
Yeah, well, they tore the lodge up, that's for sure. But he got to keep all the guns and the clothes, I think, the way Purvis indicated that the proprietor of the hotel got to keep all that stuff, and then he was able to sell it. Now, I wonder what, those guns.
I thought it sounded like he put it up, like it became, it's kind of like the very first of the murderabilia.
Right, exactly. That was early murderabilia, and he probably sold some of it. Maybe he kept some of it. I don't know if they may have done a kind of as a tourist attraction, the Little Bohemia Lodge for a while, if I remember right, back in the 30s and on in the 40s. It probably after during World War II, it probably all changed and kind of went to ruin. That stuff was not as popular.
I mean, I would think if they brought back the cars, you could keep the car and be like, well, this was Al Capone's. Or
yeah,
this
wouldn't
was,
that be something? John Dillinger's car. John Dillinger's car.
Nelson was driving in this car.
Right. Wouldn't that be something to have that or one of those machine guns or bulletproof vests or even the clothes? Man, today, it would really be worth a lot of money.
It'd be hard to kind of actually verify that it was.
Well, it kind of depends on the provenance, and they use that word provenance on history detectives, on how you find the history to prove that something really is what you claim it is. It really was John Dillinger's suit that was he left behind at the Battle of Little Bohemia. And
yeah.
You can go back and you get letters, for example. You get a descendant of the original owner of that, and then they write a letter and said, I found this in a suitcase in my father's possessions along with, and maybe have a note and said, John Dillinger's suit. You find stuff
note,
like that.
Note from the FBI that says, hey, we're returning this stuff that we found for
right.
Your...
Maybe a description, a brown man's three-piece suit. Returned to him, and then you have that brown man's three-piece suit that is of the era, then you probably get, then you can rightfully claim that it was Dillinger's suit. It just kind of depends. Sometimes, and a lot of that stuff just gets lost because people don't really see the value in it at the time, and especially, like I said, World War II came along. Nobody cared then. I just want to put that back in the background, even on up in the 50s. But now in the 2000s, that stuff has become extremely valuable.
Yeah. Well, and then the other question I kind of would have would really be about the agent, Carter Baum,
yeah,
who was killed. And, you know, here they mention in the writing about his widow.
Yeah, did you notice that Purvis said that at the time there was really not any government resources? You got killed in the line of duty, you just your check ended and you were just done. Yeah, today it's even more now. At one time it was any law enforcement officer, the federal government, as a federal statute passed that any law enforcement officer that gets killed in the line of duty, their next of kin gets $100,000, and there's always a lot more than that coming in for a policeman or an agent or somebody gets killed in the line of duty. Plus, your pension, your next of kin will draw your pension that you would have had for the rest of their life. So there's
but those are things that came in place later on.
Right. There's a lot of resources now, but back then there was none.
Yeah, and let alone the other agent who Jay Newman, who I think it said got shot in the head.
Yeah, he was wounded. I don't know how bad that was. I've never read any more about him. Hopefully he healed up, or they gave him a desk job or something. You never know. Things were different in 1934 than they are today. There was no safety net, social net. There's no,
there was no policemen's or firemen's pension funds.
Pension funds. There was really nothing for anybody, really. No Medicare, Medicaid, no food stamps.
But, I mean, in the 1930s and the Depression, it was probably a pretty good job.
Oh, yeah. Any job was a good job, especially working for the government, regular paycheck coming in. You didn't have to worry about them going bankrupt or something like that.
Right. I mean, they're up there, and they're in Wisconsin, and they're on a field duty, and they're probably commandeering breakfast.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to put this on an expense account. You just tell them the FBI is going to – I mean, what do? They got to –
Back then, I don't know, today they get a per diem and they get reimbursed. You just keep the receipts or whatever, and depending on what agency it is, a lot of them just go on a deal like that. And when you get your next paycheck and you've been out of town, you'll get a per diem for every day that you're out of town. That's usually quite liberal.
Yeah. They probably didn't have that back then.
No, they didn't have any per diem back then. You probably paid for it out of your own pocket.
Yeah, they all went over to Voss's place in kind of rotation,
yeah,
and had breakfast.
Yeah. And they probably had to pay out of their own pocket. And if they didn't, probably, people are a lot different back then, too. They would have welcomed the agents in and probably fed them. Everything was different back then.
Oddly enough, they found guns and ammo and cars and bulletproof vests of John Dillinger, but no cash.
No cash, yeah. Cash was gone. He probably had stuck that in his pockets, and if he had more than enough to put in his pockets, he put it in a little briefcase, a little sack or something, and when he took off, he did not leave the cash behind. Of course, he just goes and robs another bank. Because, as our friend the Boonie Hat Bandit said, you rob a bank because that's where the money is. So that was Willie Sutton that said that first, though, I think.
But the Boonie Hat Bandit did say it to us as
he
well.
He did say that to us. He said, he said a lot of people have said that to me. All right, well, that's quite an exciting story. And I like sharing those old newspaper articles with people to get, we talk about out of the mouths of the men who did it. Well, this is right out of, we can't get Melvin Purvis in the studio. We can't even get him on the phone because he's long dead, but we can get his firsthand account of the Battle of Little Bohemia.
As read by Paul Kim.
Yes. Thank you, Paul Kim, former Kansas City police officer. Aaron, if you know anybody that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, tell them to make their first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to rent or buy. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to want to get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour, for $1.99. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. While you're listening to the podcast, then you're going to want to break out a little bit more money, because Gary has a new book that comes from the mouth of the men that did it. The wiretap recordings is distilled down, written down for you to read, or if you get the Kindle version of his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.